It doesn't mean you have to support the lesser of two evils. You keep doing that and you start to feel a little bit evil your own self. But whatever you do, get out there and vote, man. Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. When Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. was in Congress from 1945 to 1971, he wrote something like 98% of the social legislation on this planet, and he inspired a lot of other lawmakers who came after him. Brilliant. God, was he brilliant. Brother Adam was, you know, how there are some people you like to see one more time on this earth. Well, for me, one of them is Adam. I mean, he told white folks, go fuck yourself. He went to Colgate University. The average white person around him didn't know what Colgate was. They thought it was a kind of toothpaste. But he carried himself like he didn't have to apologize for anything. At the time, he was one of the greatest preachers in America, if not the greatest, and there was nobody in Hollywood as handsome as he was. His colleagues were a pool of white men who wrote legislation that affected the whole world. Adam had the same position they did, but that didn't stop him from coming up against racism. Take, for instance, a story of when he went to the congressional dining hall one day. A sergeant-at-arms said to him, "Where you going, nigger?" Adam said, "You talking to me?" "Yeah, nigger." I'm going to eat." "Niggers can't eat here." "Well, where do we?" "There's a place about 10 miles from here where all the educated, sophisticated niggers go." "So how do I get there?" "Well, you can take a cab. The man to see, his name is Billy Simpson." So about an hour later, Adam came back to the dining hall with the most ghetto-looking black man you ever saw in your life. Scraggly beard, overalls, no shirt, barefoot. So the sergeant-at-arms came up to Adam again and said, "Did you find it, boy?" Then he saw the man Adam had with him and said, "Who is this?" "Oh," Adam said, "this man's name is Billy Simpson. I thought this is who you were telling me about. That the only way I could get in here was to bring this nigger with me." I guess the sergeant didn't know there was more than one Billy Simpson. And that's when all hell broke loose. Adam told the sergeant-at-arms, "I either come in here or I'm whooping your behind and I'm throwing all the food away." That was Adam. Adam was born in Connecticut in 1908. His parents were of mixed race. The same year he was born, his father became pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in Harlem, which had a congregation of 10,000 folks. So Adam grew up wealthy. He was also light-skinned enough to pass for white, which he did for a while in college. But he didn't keep that up. He came back to New York City from Colgate, got a master's degree in religious education from Columbia University, and started working in his dad's church. He also became an activist on behalf of black people. When businesses wouldn't hire black folks, Adam organized pickets and marches. He set up soup kitchens and other services for people in the community, and to draw attention to it all, he founded a newspaper, The People's Voice. That helped him win a seat on the New York City Council in 1941. He ran for Congress in 1944, calling for civil rights and an end to job discrimination against blacks. For the first 10 years, he was one of only 2 blacks in all of Congress. He butted heads with racist Southern Democrats. He was outspoken. He made himself heard. He advised presidents to support African countries struggling to win independence, and he was relentless with his civil rights work. In 1954, the Supreme Court decided, in the matter of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, Kansas, that segregated schools were unconstitutional. But that didn't mean school districts were in a rush to desegregate. Adam knew that. He wrote up what's called a rider, saying that schools in the South couldn't get federal funds until they fell in line with desegregation, and he attached that rider to a bunch of bills in Congress. That later became part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Title VI of the Act says there can't be race discrimination in programs that get federal money. We owe that to Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. That's the kind of thing that outraged other congressmen. They were out to get Adam. I don't want to say he was perfect, but neither were his colleagues, and they punished him for doing exactly what they were doing because he was black and proud and didn't apologize for it. They nailed him for taking trips at public expense and making committee meetings, taking away his committee chairmanship, and finally kicking him out of Congress altogether. Then he won a special election to fill his own vacant seat. He served until 1970 when Charles Rangel beat him in the election. When his enemies in Congress were coming after him, Adams said, "I wish to state very emphatically that I will always do just what every other congressman and committee chairman has done and is doing and will do." That was Adam, a tough, bad black man till the end. The murder of Emmett Till. Now they say Rosa Parks was a spark of the civil rights movement, but I tell you who sparked Rosa Parks. Emmett Till's mama, Mammy. Emmett Till was a 14-year-old black boy from Chicago who went to see some relatives in a little town in Mississippi in 1955. The name of the town was Money. Now, isn't that something? It's as if folks wanted to name the town after the thing they cared about the most, but they couldn't call the town Killing Negroes, so they had to settle for the next best thing. One day, Emmett was in a store in the town, and they said that he looked at and whistled at a 21-year-old white woman. Or so they said. They called it reckless eyeballing. Boy, what did he do that for? Couple of days later, the woman's husband and the husband's half-brother went to where Emmett was staying and kidnapped him. What they did to that poor boy. It'd be quicker to tell you what they didn't do. When they ran out of ways to torture him, they shot him and threw his body in the Tallahatchie River. After Emmett's body was pulled from the river and sent back to Chicago for the funeral, that was when Mammy Till gave the world the shock it needed. She insisted on having an open casket funeral service so the world could see what those men had done to her boy, the men who got away with it and then later admitted they'd done it. So many thousands of people attended that funeral and saw Emmett's body. A whole bunch fainted, and a whole bunch more needed smelling salts. And with good reason. Ever seen a monster movie or a zombie movie? I'm telling you, the Oscar-winningest makeup man in Hollywood couldn't make somebody look like that boy looked in his casket. Then John H. Johnson published photos of Emmett's face in Jet magazine, and then everybody saw it, including Rosa Parks. Rosa Parks. One day I was talking to Rosa Parks. I said to her, just teasing her, "When you refused to give up your seat on that bus, you wasn't just tired like white folks said you was." She started crying, and I couldn't believe the answer she gave me. Martin Luther King Jr., who gets all the credit for everything, was just an earnest Baptist preacher. His consciousness came from the white schools he went to, and he had that twang that Baptist preachers have that white folks can't understand. That's why all we ever heard of him on the TV networks was sound bites. "Going to the mountaintop." And the rest of that stuff you hear year in and year out on his birthday. But think about Rosa Parks and the effect she had on the whole planet. She didn't have a church behind her like King did, but look what she did. When she refused to give up her bus seat to a white dude and got arrested for it, black and white folks rallied around her. That day I spoke to her. We were just kicking back, having dinner at a hotel. I was only playing when I said, "Look at your pretty feet." And they wanted to say you wouldn't give up your seat because you were tired. Think about it. White folks try to say that if Rosa hadn't been too tired to get up from her seat that day, none of it would have ever happened. Everything that sparked the civil rights movement, that's what we let historians get away with. I said to her, "Tell me. You tell me what happened." And when she did, she caught me by surprise. She sounded almost like she was in a trance. "I just couldn't get Emmett Till off my mind," she said. Rosa was born in 1913 in Tuskegee, Alabama. Her daddy was one angry man because he wanted to be a Garveyite. Garveyites were those black folks who followed Marcus Garvey, a Jamaican-born black nationalist who advocated Pan-Africanism and the economic and political empowerment of blacks. But Marcus Garvey didn't accept light-skinned Negroes, and Rosa's dad was one. So instead, he had to make do with sitting on his porch with his double-barrel shotgun, daring white folks to mess with him. At the time of the bus incident, Rosa was a secretary for the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP. White folks like to say she was just some tired housewife who didn't want to stand up on the bus that day, but she was no less an activist than Martin Luther King Jr. In Montgomery, Alabama, where it happened, Negroes had to sit at the back of the bus, behind the white folks. But here's one thing I didn't know. They had to get on the bus at the front door, pay the fare, and then get off and walk to the back door. When black folks got on at the back, they might find white boys in the back flirting with the black sisters, and most of those women who would be flirting back, smiling and saying, "Oh, come on, Ed, you don't mean it." But not Rosa Parks. She didn't play that mess. When white boys tried flirting with her, she'd say, "Don't you ever say that to me again, you son of a bitch, you." Also, if you were black and you were sitting in the last row of seats reserved for white folks, and a white person wanted to sit down in that row, in your seat, then the three other blacks in the same row had to get up too. It wasn't just one seat involved. That was segregation for you. Anyway, a couple of times when Rosa got off the bus to walk to the back door after paying her fare up front, the driver drove off and left her. One driver in particular. When she was describing that famous day to me, Rosa said, "Had I known that was him," meaning the driver who had given her trouble before, "I wouldn't have got on that bus." But that's the universe at work. So there's Rosa sitting in the first row, the colored section, when a white guy gets on and there are no free seats in the white section. Later this man would say, "We were getting off in a couple of stops." So he wasn't the one trying to make Rosa Parks give up her seat. He figured it wasn't worth the trouble, but the bus driver, the same one Rosa wanted to avoid, went back there and called her a nigger bitch and told her to get up. But Rosa wasn't having it. She wasn't just tired. She was mad as hell because she was thinking about Emmett Till. The Montgomery bus boycott. Today you've got cops killing black folks. Over nothing. Just because they're black. Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, too many to name. Our black children, our black husbands, every now and then a black woman. And some black activists are trying to do something, but a lot of black people don't care because they're scared. There's a way to fight back, though. If we would just organize and think about one word. Retail. One-third of all retail sales happen between Thanksgiving and Christmas. In other words, in 1 month, businesses make a third of all the money they make all year. Now, unless your daddy's a businessman, you probably didn't know that. But now you know. So if we all said, because of these black men being killed, we're calling for a boycott from Thanksgiving through Christmas. If we did that, we would be heard. We've taken this kind of action in the past. What am I talking about? Down south in the 1950s. The bus boycotts. It started in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. Everybody knows Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus in Montgomery, and that sparked the bus boycotts. But what some people forget is this. The reason the boycotts worked was because the buses were a business, and when they couldn't get black folks money, they were brought to their knees. We black folks got sick of paying our money for the privilege of being abused by all white drivers and being told where we could and couldn't sit. Martin Luther King Jr. organized the boycott hoping that 60% of black people would participate. Instead, 90% to 100% of us did, because we'd had enough. Black folks got together and said no more, and it worked. The bus company gave in to our demands. Then the boycott spread to other cities. That's what we need to do today. The Montgomery bus boycott went on for 381 days, over a year, but I'm only talking about boycotting businesses for 1 month. We've got to decide what we want. Do we want to protect our sons and daughters and husbands and wives and mothers? Or do we want to spend money we don't even have on stupid toys and then tell our kids they came from a white man named Santa Claus? Do we want our kids to grow up safe? Or do we want to freeze our behinds off waiting for stores to open on Black Friday and then trample one another to death trying to get to a pair of sneakers? In the spirit of Christmas? We all know it would be easier on us all around to just not shop because we know that we don't have the money. We can say that it's for a good reason. Protesting police brutality. Pullman Porters and the Montgomery Improvement Association. I want to tell you a story about cooperation. It starts back in the 19th century. George Pullman was one smart white guy. In the mid-1860s, just about the time slavery ended, he designed his own line of railroad sleeping cars. Pullman cars. That's not what proved he was smart. Any fool could have came up with that. What made George Pullman smart was that he realized he needed folks to work on those cars. And because he was in business, he didn't want to pay those workers more than he had to. So, now you're looking to hire porters for the sleeping cars, and you want them cheap, and slavery has just breathed its last sorry-ass breath. So what do you do? Hire black folks. Yes, that George Pullman was one smart white dude. Well, anyway, you have to admit his timing was good. He really was smart, though, for this reason. In the 19th century, all rich folks were white, but not all white folks were rich. Matter of fact, a lot of them were struggling to get by, some of them not doing too much better than some black folks. The only way those white folks had servants was in their dreams. George Pullman figured it this way. As long as white folks were sleeping in his cars, he'd give them their dreams. If they took an overnight train trip, they could sleep in a Pullman car and pretend for as long as they were on it that they were Massa himself, with a big old 6'3" pearly white teeth grinning Negro waiting on them hand and foot. Now, this wasn't exactly a bargain for the porters. At least it wasn't supposed to be. But show me a Negro, and I'll show you somebody who knows how to turn a messed up situation to his advantage. By the time the porters finished paying for their own uniforms and for the polish that went on white folks' shoes, they may not have had two dimes to rub together from their salaries. Still, they got paid in something else. Information from folks who forgot those 6'3" pitch black silent grinning men had ears and brains. Hell, they forgot they were there at all. Those Negroes may as well have been invisible. The white folks got to talking about how the stock market was going to be fixed and other tidbits about Wall Street, and the porters took that information and what little money they had, and they made a killing. That's why so many of the Pullman porters died millionaires and so many of their children finished college. Thurgood Marshall? Dad was a Pullman porter. Meanwhile, if you were a porter and you recommended your son or nephew, he could be one too. One leaves, another comes in. It was the closest thing black folks had to an inheritance, and it kept on until the 20th century. Now watch this here. The porters had a problem because when they came south, they couldn't stay in hotels, couldn't go to restaurants. Good old Jim Crow in action. So black folks down south would put them up. Meanwhile, after Rosa Parks did what she did, E.D. Nixon and other folks in Montgomery formed the Montgomery Improvement Association to boycott the bus system. When word of the boycott got out, folks from around the world sent money to the association to support it, but white bankers wouldn't open an account for the association to put the money in. Now you might say, what kind of banker doesn't want money in his bank? That's how much white supremacists hated black folks. So the association gave the money to Pullman porters to deposit in a bank up north. That's how those millions of dollars got into the movement. That's what we can do when we work together. Cooperation, man. The Little Rock Nine. Melba Patillo Beals. Minnie Jean Brown. Elizabeth Eckford. Ernest Green. Gloria Ray Kallmark. Carlotta Walls Lanier. Thelma Mothershed, Terrence Roberts, Jefferson Thomas. These nine were a lot like Jackie Robinson when he integrated Major League Baseball. Just like Jackie, they were sent into a place where they would be the only black people. Just like Jackie, they were chosen because they were good at what they did. And just like Jackie, they were told they couldn't fight back if anybody gave them trouble. Difference was, Jackie was a grown man when he did what he did, and the nine I just named were all in their teens in 1957, the year they integrated Little Rock Central High School in Arkansas. They were kids. That was a lot to put on some kids, even if they were brave, and they were. If they were brave, other folks were acting like fools, or worse. In 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court had ruled that segregation in public schools was unconstitutional. But after that, it wasn't like the all-white schools were in a race to see who could integrate first. It took the NAACP to get in people's faces and demand desegregation. That was how the school board in Little Rock came up with its plan to integrate Central High first and then move on to some junior high schools. It chose the nine black students because they had good grades and good attendance records. The nine showed up at the school on September 4th, and all hell broke loose. The governor of Arkansas was Orville Faubus. Now, you would have thought those nine students were the love children of Godzilla and King Kong, the way Faubus reacted to them. He didn't just say he didn't want them in the school. He called out the Arkansas National Guard to make sure they didn't get in. Not that he needed to. The day the nine tried to enter the school, racist whites lined the streets holding signs, yelling all kinds of hateful stuff, and even spitting in those poor kids' faces. Those nine kids weren't monsters. But for that mob, they represented something just as scary. The idea that black kids were just as good as their kids. That blacks were people just like them. A world without somebody to look down on was just too horrible for those white folks to think about. Well, what happened in Little Rock made news all over the country. Dwight Eisenhower, Ike, was president at the time, and when the whole nation saw what was going on down there, he was forced to act. He federalized the Arkansas National Guard, meaning that instead of doing what Faubus told them to do, they had to do what Ike said. So now instead of blocking the students from going into the school, the guard had to protect them from the angry mob. Then Ike went one better than that and sent in the 101st Airborne Division of the U.S. Army, minus his black soldiers. Ike must have figured that if the whites in Little Rock saw a bunch of uniformed black folks coming at them, there would be another civil war. After 20 days, the nine students were finally able to attend school, but it wasn't as if their problems were over. White students harassed them like it was their job, and most of the time, the National Guard, who had been sent inside the school to protect the nine students, didn't do a thing. At an age when kids should be thinking about who's going to be their prom date and what colleges they might apply to, those nine students had to wake up every morning knowing they had to attend a school full of folks who hated them. Just like Jackie Robinson, the Little Rock Nine made a sacrifice for others. Those kids served their country as much as any soldier. That's why in 1999, President Bill Clinton gave each of them the Congressional Gold Medal. We have fought a great deal for education. I find it astounding that young people randomly drop out of school these days because the teacher doesn't like me and other nonsense. Trust me, freedom is found in education. Desegregating lunch counters. Desegregating lunch counters in 1960. That was done by young people too. But they weren't from the NAACP, even though the NAACP was putting up the bell when those young people got arrested. No, these were youngsters going in there on their own. College students who had been inspired by Martin Luther King Jr.'s nonviolent protests. They didn't just decide one day to go into those establishments and sit down. They first had to learn how to do it. Activists like James Lawson trained them, teaching them how to sit still at the counters while white folks cussed at them, called them names, or worse, hit them, threw raw eggs at them. Believe me, that stuff is not easy. Our instinct would be to fight, or maybe to run, but to just sit there? That took some serious discipline, not to mention guts. Those young people knew they could die. One thing, as an American, you've been taught to fight back. So how long does it take to train a person so he goes from not taking stuff from anybody to saying, I gotta take some stuff off white folks, but I'm not gonna hit them back? So when the activist went to the Woolworth lunch counter in Greensboro, North Carolina, sat there, they knew what to expect. There were four of them at first. Ezell Blair Jr., Franklin McCain, Joseph McNeil, and David Richmond, all students at North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University. Soon they would be called the Greensboro Four. The first day, the four of them sat at the counter and asked politely for coffee. The server said no, and the manager asked them to leave. But the four stayed until the place closed that night. The next day they went back, and 20 other black students from different schools joined them. By that time, there were newspaper reporters and a TV camera present. Third day, 60 people. Fourth day, more than 300. A few days after that, the lunch counter protest spread to other southern cities like Richmond, Virginia, and Nashville, Tennessee. Meanwhile, people boycotted other stores in Greensboro with segregated lunch counters, and it cut into the store's profits so bad that the manager said, "To hell with it," and desegregated the lunch counters. The same approach worked when it came to black folks traveling on integrated buses. They'd get on the buses, racist whites would stop the buses, and the Ku Klux Klan would be waiting to whoop them, and those brave, disciplined young people just took it. Then all at once, the story started hitting the papers, and readers were embarrassed to see people beating on folks who weren't fighting back. That's how people's minds and the laws got changed. Through young black people's bravery. And messing with folks' money a bit. Dorothy Height and the National Council of Negro Women. Dorothy Height was president of the National Council of Negro Women. She was born in Virginia in 1912. When she was young, her family moved to Pennsylvania, and she went to integrated schools. She was so good at speaking that she won a national competition in high school that got her a college scholarship. She was on her way. Barnard College in New York City accepted her and then changed its mind. It took only two black students a year, and apparently it already had its two. Heights didn't let this discourage her, though. She enrolled at New York University and got her bachelor's and master's degrees there. At 25, she joined the National Council of Negro Women, which was started in 1935 by Mary McLeod Bethune, who figured that there were so many organizations for black women around the country that they needed to talk to one another a little bit. That's what the council was for. Bethune was the first woman to run it, and then she handed it off to Dorothy Farabee. Next after that was Vivian Carter Mason. And then, in 1957, just when things were heating up good with the civil rights movement and all the folks opposed to it, Dorothy Height took over the organization. She couldn't have picked a tougher or more exciting time to do it. When we black folks started demanding our rights in the South, things turned violent. Black and white folks got beaten, arrested, killed. Height took a peaceful approach to the whole thing. She arranged for what she called Wednesdays in Mississippi. Groups of women of different races went around together in the summer of 1964 to try to improve how black and whites related to one another and to help with voter registration. Now, if it wasn't bad enough that she had to watch black people get mistreated, she also had her own people mistreating her. Even though she was in charge of a major civil rights organization, and even though she helped organize the 1963 March on Washington, black men didn't ask her to speak at it. She was standing right there, near Martin Luther King Jr., when he was giving his I Have a Dream speech, and she didn't get to say a word. One civil rights leader, James Farmer, even admitted it. He later called Height one of the big six in the civil rights movement, along with King, Farmer, John Lewis, Roy Wilkins, and Whitney Young, but said she didn't get credit because she was a woman. Sure enough, a lot of people put A. Philip Randolph in the Big Six instead of Height, and don't think she wasn't aware of it herself. She said the men in the group were happy to include women in the human family, but there was no question as to who headed the household. Whatever list she was or wasn't on, Height made herself and her organization heard. She advised President Dwight Eisenhower to integrate schools and leaned on President Lyndon Johnson to place black women in positions in government. Height was president of the National Council of Negro Women for 40 years. Another U.S. president, Bill Clinton, gave her the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 1994. and in 2004 she was awarded the Congressional Gold Medal. She died in 2010, at 98 years old. When he gave her eulogy, President Obama called her the godmother of civil rights. Selma. The march in Selma, Alabama, in 1965 wasn't about voting rights, as many historians would have you believe. It was about a civil rights worker named Jimmie Lee Jackson. This church deacon, 26 years old, went to vote, and they wouldn't let him. It was about Jimmie Lee, and being a turtle. Let me explain. Remember one thing. 66 million years ago, that big horrible thing, the asteroid bigger than mountains, killed the dinosaurs. That's the information they feed to you, your children, and your grandchildren. What they don't tell you is when the dinosaur was here, so was the turtle, and so was the butterfly. That was 66 million years ago, and the turtle and the butterfly are still here. Gorgeous, pretty, not evil or mean or horrible. The turtle just makes his way along, real slow. And that's how we won the civil rights movement. We took on the mightiest nation in the history of the planet with no guns, and we did it by becoming turtles. Hard on the outside, soft on the inside, and willing to stick our necks out. We need to recognize that as strength. In February 1965, Jimmie Lee Jackson was part of a march in Marion, Alabama. The marchers were protesting the arrest of another worker, James Orange. Now, this was a peaceful protest, but the Alabama state troopers didn't care about peaceful. All they heard was protest, and they thought it was time to bust heads. And worse, the night of the protest, they turned off all the streetlights in the town, and when it was good and dark, the troopers went at those folks with clubs, but not just clubs. The protesters took off running. Jimmie Lee and some others wound up in a restaurant, Max Cafe. Jimmie Lee's mother and granddaddy were there too, and the troopers started beating all of them. When they began beating Jimmie Lee's granddaddy, his mother went to pull them off, and they started whooping her. They shot Jimmie Lee in the belly 5 times and then carried him off to jail to book him. Didn't take him to a hospital till the next day. A few days later, he died. That's what the march in Selma was about. It wasn't about voting rights. It was about Jimmie Lee Jackson. And when that march happened, that's when all hell broke loose. You go by Jimmie Lee Jackson's grave back then, and they're sitting there with rifles, shooting a tombstone. For those who haven't been to jail but kind of wonder in the back of their minds what it was like in the civil rights days, well, let me explain it to you. First day you get arrested, the food is horrible. Second day, it's miserable. The third day, it doesn't taste too bad. The fourth day, you're asking for the recipe. By the time I got down south to protest, blood was running in the streets. I left the hotel one night to get a case of whiskey, because I drank with this one state trooper every night. This trooper was a brother, married to a black woman, lived in a black neighborhood. His children went to black schools, but the white folks thought he was white. So he came to see me with this look on his face. I said, "What's happening, man? Where's the whiskey?" He said, "I was at this meeting, man, and tomorrow they've got 300 white folks who came in from all over the South. They're gonna kill all of y'all. And our job is to rope off the press so they can't get across the street. I'm just thankful I know you, man, so you can tell the folks." I guess he thought if I told the marchers about the danger, we'd all stay home. I said, "I'm not gonna tell them nothing. I came here to die. I don't wanna die. I came here to die. So tomorrow we die." The next day we were there, and the trooper who had warned me, and who was on duty now and passing for white, looked at me with tears in his eyes, shaking his head and whispered, "You didn't tell them." We were there, old black folks, young black folks, singing, "Glory, glory, hallelujah, my eyes have seen the glory." We were marching. Then at a certain point we got to one corner, and just like my trooper friend had told me, the troopers had roped off the press. Then I looked in another direction and saw a whole lot of angry white folks waiting on us. I thought about my wife and my children, but this was war. I saw that the white mob had pickaxes, rifles, clubs. I thought, I sure don't want to die. If I'd known this was going to happen, I'd have got me a little pussy before I left home. Then the marchers saw all the armed white folks, but we kept singing and we kept praying. Most of us didn't know what was fixing to happen. Then all of a sudden, I saw those white folks shaking. They were scared. A look had come over their faces. It was like I had died and gone to another planet. I looked at them and they dropped their pickaxes. They had this horrible look on their faces, and 2 years later, I figured out what it was. We marchers were out there, unafraid, willing to die but not to kill. And well, those folks saw the spirit of God in us. We kept marching, and we kept marching. Shirley Chisholm runs for president. Here's a lesson on how people's minds get messed up. Shirley Chisholm, the first black congresswoman in America, was born in 1924 in Brooklyn, New York. Family didn't have much money. From the ages 3 to 10, Shirley lived on her grandmother's farm in Barbados in the Caribbean. Barbados is more than 90% black. Think about that. For 7 years when she was a small child, which is when your mind and your ideas about the world are forming, she wasn't around anybody but black folks. She didn't see black folks being told they were inferior to white folks or acting like they were. There were almost no white folks around for them to feel inferior to. She got to see black folks in charge. Black people in the Caribbean felt differently about themselves. Not like here, where we grow up being told in 100 different ways that we're no good, and we believe it, and we don't even know we believe it. In her book, Unbought and Unbossed, Shirley Chisholm writes that Barbados is a rocky place, not lush like Jamaica or Trinidad. Folks there weren't sitting around sipping piña coladas. They were serious. They may have been mostly farmers, but when they went to school, they learned. And the ones who came to the United States came with a purpose. Chisholm writes in a book that they all wanted the same two things, a brownstone house and a college education for their children. And most of them got it. Chisholm certainly got a college education and then some. Studied at Brooklyn College and then got a master's degree at Columbia University. Studied elementary education and won prizes for debating. She was so good at debating, in fact, that folks told her she should go into politics. Next thing you know, she was in the New York State Assembly, and after that, the U.S. Congress starting in 1968. When she got there, they tried to put her on the Agriculture Committee. They must have thought the people she represented rode tractors instead of the subway. But Shirley wasn't having it. She told them just what they could do with their agriculture committee. And that's how she got on the education and labor committees, working on stuff people cared about. After that, she ran for president. In fact, she became the first woman Democrat and the first black woman from a major party to do it. Weren't too many folks thinking about a black president in 1972. But as Shirley said, somebody had to do it first. See, that's the kind of thinking you can do when you don't feel you're inferior to other folks. And Shirley didn't just run. In a New Jersey primary, she came out ahead of a white dude named Terry Sanford, who had been governor of North Carolina. Now, all this tells you what she did, but it doesn't tell you who she was. Now, look at this. That same year, 1972, George Wallace ran for president. I'll say this one thing for Wallace. He was honest. He didn't like black folks, and he told people he didn't like black folks. When he was the governor of Alabama, his unofficial motto was segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever, and he meant what he said. Which is why he went to the University of Alabama in person in 1963 to block black students from getting in there. You hear me? He didn't send in the police. He went there himself. Then on May 15, 1972, Wallace got shot. He was paralyzed for the rest of his life. While he was in the hospital, you know who went to visit him? Shirley Chisholm. Black people gave her 99 kinds of grief for doing that, but she believed it was the right thing to do. Even Wallace was moved. He asked her, "What are your people gonna say?" She told him, "I know what they're going to say, but I wouldn't want what happened to you to happen to anyone." Wallace never did stop crying over that. He was humbled by the African-American values Shirley Chisholm was showing. integrity, compassion, kindness. Jesse Jackson runs for president. Jesse Jackson probably has one of the most brilliant minds on the planet. A lot of people didn't know his genius till he ran for president in 1984 and 1988. He surprised a lot of folks then. They didn't think he had a chance because he was what the media called a fringe candidate. Not only was he black, but he had never held elected office. But the establishment started paying attention when a whole lot of people voted for him. Jackson was born in 1941 in South Carolina. His mama wasn't but 16 years old, and she wasn't married to Jesse's daddy, who was 33 and married to somebody else. Jesse's mother later married another man, and Jesse took his stepfather's last name, Jackson. Even after that, though, Jesse got teased by the other kids because his parents weren't married. The pain of that must have stayed with him. He lived under segregation, too, riding in the back of the bus and all the rest of it. He did all right as a young man, though. Got good grades in school and earned letters in football, baseball, and basketball. Went to college at the University of Illinois and then North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University. Then he went to the Chicago Theological Seminary and almost got a master's degree, but he got so caught up in the civil rights movement that he left school. He was with Martin Luther King Jr. and James Bevel on the march from Selma to Montgomery. In 1965, Jackson went to work for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, the SCLC, and King and Bevel put him in charge of the SCLC's Operation Breadbasket, which is all about getting jobs for black folks. That's where Jesse's brilliance started to come out. In the same way that King had used boycotts to make it so black folks wouldn't have to ride at the back of the bus anymore, Jackson applied the idea to jobs, organizing boycotts of white-owned businesses to pressure them into hiring more black folks. The plan worked. After King got killed, Ralph Abernathy took over the SCLC, and he and Jackson clashed like two cymbals. When Abernathy tried to take Operation Breadbasket away from him, Jesse and his whole staff left the SCLC and formed another organization, Operation Push. The Push stood for People United to Save Humanity, which Jesse later changed to People United to Serve Humanity. Jesse would lead rallies, standing there before big crowds of black folks and filling them with pride. He'd raise his fist and shout in that passionate southern voice, "I am somebody," and people would raise their fist and shout it right back at him. Whole stadiums full of people repeating after Jesse, "I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I may be unskilled, but I am somebody. I am black, beautiful, proud. I must be respected." I've heard it said that when Jesse was saying, "I am somebody," he was saying it partly to himself, thinking about when he was teased as a boy because his parents weren't married. Later, Jesse started making a move toward politics. In 1984, he ran for president himself. He stepped down as head of Operation Push and formed a Rainbow Coalition. Jesse's whole thing was that oppressed people, black, poor whites, Hispanics, women, needed one another. Now here was Jesse, a black man who had never been elected to anything, running for president of the United States. Of course, they didn't take him seriously as a candidate. That is, until he finished up ahead of every office-holding Democrat except Senator Gary Hart and former Vice President Walter Mondale. Mondale ended up losing big to President Reagan that fall. Maybe Jesse hadn't held office before, but the things he was saying meant something to people. Despite the loss, in 1988 he was back, this time with more money and better organization. Still, he got knocked out by Michael Dukakis, who got his butt kicked in November by George W. Bush's daddy, George H.W. Bush. By the time he spoke at the 1988 Democratic National Convention, Jesse's candidacy was over. But he gave one hell of a speech. He told the crowd, "America is not a blanket woven from one thread, one color, one cloth. When I was a child growing up in Greenville, South Carolina, and grandmama could not afford a blanket, she didn't complain and we did not freeze. Instead, she took pieces of old cloth, patches, wool, silk, gabardine, croaker sack. Only patches, barely good enough to wipe off your shoes with, but they didn't stay that way very long. With sturdy hands and a strong cord, she sewed them together into a quilt, a thing of beauty and power and culture. Now, Democrats, we must build such a quilt. Farmers, you seek fair prices and you are right, but you cannot stand alone. Your patch is not big enough. Workers, you fight for fair wages. You are right, but your patch labor is not big enough. Women, you seek comparable worth and pay equity. You are right, but your patch is not big enough. Women, mothers who seek Head Start and daycare and prenatal care on the front side of life, relevant jail care and welfare on the back side of life, you are right, but your patch is not big enough. Students, you seek scholarships. You are right, but your patch is not big enough. Blacks and Hispanics, when we fight for civil rights, we are right, but our patch is not big enough. Gays and lesbians, when you fight against discrimination and a cure for AIDS, you are right, but your patch is not big enough. Conservatives and progressives, when you fight for what you believe, right wing, left wing, hawk, dove, you are right from your point of view, but your point of view is not enough. But don't despair. Be as wise as my grandmama. Pull the patches and the pieces together, bound by a common thread. When we form a great quilt of unity and common ground, we'll have the power to bring about health care and housing and jobs and education and hope to our nation. We the people can win. The Million Man March. Here's how I knew the Million Man March was going to be a success. Before it was held, I was coming off a 30-day fast in Los Angeles. I don't know what got into me. I walked up this hill to go to the store to get me some bottled water, and I was so weak from the fast that that walk up the hill was kicking my behind. Then a guy from across the street called out, "Dick Gregory." He got off a ladder and ran over to me. I told him, "Help me with this water." He said, "I got my ticket to go to the Million Man March." This was 4 months before the march. That's when I knew how big it was going to be. The march took place on October 16th, 1995. The idea for it had come from Louis Farrakhan, the head of the Nation of Islam, but he worked with a number of groups to make it happen. The thinking behind it was that black men would come together from all over as a show of unity to commit to doing better as men and husbands and fathers, to demonstrate to the nation that the people thought of as criminals could gather in an orderly and peaceful way and to draw attention to the problems facing the black community. With unemployment, mass incarceration, and the Reagan administration's cuts to any kind of programs aimed at helping folks in poor communities, things were getting to a crisis stage for black people. Farrakhan was a lot of things before he was the organizer of the Million Man March. He was born Louis Eugene Walcott in 1933 in the Bronx. At 18, he went south to attend a teacher's college, but he loved music so much he tried his hand at that instead. He could sing and play the violin like nobody's business. Sang calypso. They used to call him the Charmer. Later in the 1950s, he got into activism, and in Chicago, he joined the Nation of Islam. Just like Malcolm X had given up his original surname, Little, Farrakhan became Louis X, for a while. After all, Walcott was a slave master's name. Then Elijah Muhammad, head of the Nation of Islam, gave him the last name, Farrakhan. Farrakhan worked with Malcolm X in Harlem, and then took over Temple No. 7 after Malcolm's break with the Nation. He had a lot of Malcolm's charisma. After Elijah Muhammad died, Farrakhan thought he was going to take over the Nation, but Elijah's son Wallace became the new head. Wallace broke away from black nationalism and was all about traditional Islam instead. At that point, Farrakhan broke off and started another Nation of Islam, more like the one Elijah had overseen. A lot of famous people spoke at the Million Man March. Jesse Jackson, Maya Angelou, Martin Luther King III, Benjamin Chavis, Rosa Parks, and Farrakhan. But the vast majority of the people there were just ordinary folks coming together. Farrakhan called it a day of atonement, because as much as we were telling others that things had to improve, we were also telling ourselves that we had to improve. And calling it the Million Man March? That shows you the kind of thinking we need. Farrakhan and the rest didn't wait for the media to say that there were a million people there that day. They made it a million. I met with Farrakhan and sat with him a while. I said to him, "Did you trademark the name Million Man March? Because if you didn't, the Ku Klux Klan can trademark it now and you can't use it." I took my three sons to the march with me. We got up at 4 o'clock in the morning to go. 90% of the people who came didn't have hotel rooms because the hotels were full. You had brothers flying in from everywhere, man. Some came from Europe with their own planes. 1.9 million people were there. What I wanted my sons to see as we walked through the crowd was that you couldn't smell any marijuana, you didn't see cocaine on anybody's nose, and you didn't smell alcohol. That's how much respect everybody had for the occasion, and they didn't need to take drugs or drink alcohol to feel good that day. Only 2 arrests were made the whole day. A white boy called in a bomb threat from 14th and U Streets, and they kept him on the line long enough to trace and arrest him. The other arrest was of a Chinese or Middle Eastern selling hot dogs without a permit. Nothing else. That was it. A beautiful, glorious gathering. I would put just one march ahead of them, and that was King's March on Washington in 1963, although he had just 250,000 people. Still, that 1963 march was the first time in the history of the planet that all black folks were invited to come to this major city. Not just the rich, not just the famous, not just the educated. King said, "All of y'all come." That was something else, man. Black folks were so used to being ignored that at first we didn't understand it. "You mean come to the nation's capital? I'm invited?" They came in their Sunday shoes, bunions and all, and you felt the joy. Joy. And that dirt dog President Kennedy had 7 divisions of troops surrounding the march because they thought there was going to be violence. Why? Because white folks knew that if somebody had been doing them like they'd been doing black folks, well, they'd have burned the city down. But no, man, nothing like that happened. What a glorious day. The Million Man March, well, that changed brothers' lives. After it, a lot of them joined churches, mosques, the NAACP, and other groups to try to improve our communities. The National Association of Black Social Workers received thousands of applications from people wanting to adopt black children. We proved we could come together. The Black Lives Matter movement and Michael Brown. Black Lives Matter. Almost as soon as the phrase was invented, some small-minded people came out and said, "All lives matter." How come nobody used "all lives matter" until after we had used "black lives matter"? You have to look at when the brother Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson in 2014 by the white cop Darren Wilson. I went there afterward. It happened 20 miles from where I was born. I was outraged when I got there and heard the whole story. Here was a man lying bleeding on the ground for 4.5 hours, and in all that time, you didn't see an ambulance. You didn't see a call from the coroner's office. But you best believe the cops are there, though. You think we don't see through that? We marched 24 hours a day there in Ferguson, around the clock, in protest. Not the same people, different people came, including children. There was never any violence. Well, not until after 8 o'clock on the night they announced that the grand jury was not going to indict Darren Wilson. I ask you, why'd they wait until after it got dark to read the grand jury's verdict? I'll tell you why. Because they knew that nighttime is when violence can occur. I was there when that grand jury finding came down. I saw the reaction. I told Marty King, "Get out of here, man. Something's not right about this. Get out." We black folks can't see through this kind of behavior by white folks, but we'll say to one another, Oh, we shouldn't use the word nigger. We have to use N-word. Why did the word nigger get changed to the N-word? And why were we stupid enough to go along with it? The word got changed because of the O.J. Simpson trial. There are millions of people who believe that O.J. Simpson killed his wife and Ron Goldman, and they believe Detective Mark Furman's racist statements and his use of the word nigger are why O.J. went free. Then some white person decided that it was time to get rid of that word, and we black folks are stupid enough to go along with it. Saying N-word is an insult to me. Suppose one day men feel bad because of the way we have raped women, and those of us who didn't rape them feel bad because we sat by and didn't say anything, and so we decide to change rape to the R-word. That's an insult. Dorian Johnson was Michael Brown's best friend and had been present at his shooting. Johnson said that Brown's hands were up when Darren Wilson shot him. Saying that is not a federal crime, so why are people saying the FBI put him under witness protection? Because he was testifying to the grand jury. Turns out he lied. Here's a man who was lying about Michael Brown's hands-up stance. And on the night the grand jury decision came down, his friend DeAndre Joshua was murdered. He was shot and his body burned up in a car. That was Johnson's friend. But more important than that, Joshua was killed two blocks from where the prosecutor read the announcement about the grand jury decision. And nobody talks about it. That's what this is about. So when you stop and look at what they do and how they do it, then you've got to say, hey, something's not right. Now let's look at the prosecuting attorney, Robert McCulloch. If you're a white prosecuting attorney anywhere in America and you're elected by a county that's predominantly white and you have to send your children to school with their children and you have a mortgage to pay and all kinds of other responsibilities, are you really going to try very hard to win an indictment for a white cop when you've got to go to those same folks to get reelected? What kind of fool would you have to be to do that? And we're surprised when McCulloch prosecutes a grand jury case that doesn't lead to Darren Wilson's indictment? Are we fools too? Obama. First, when it comes to President Barack Obama, I have to apologize to white folks. I mean it. Up until Obama became president, I really believed that all white folks thought all black folks looked alike. But after Obama got in office, I didn't have a single white person run up to me and say, "Excuse me, Mr. President." I really want to believe Obama's smart, but to let somebody put you in charge of a raggedy old, broken down, evil, hateful, ungodly, and spiritual system of government like the one in this country, you've got to be a fool. I mean, please. After Obama was elected, he called me and asked, "What must I do?" I said, "Ask for a recount." But here's how Obama changed things around the world. If you've been following the G8 and G20 meetings all over the world for the last 20 years, you've seen the white children have shown up outside those meetings, and whoever was the U.S. president at the time, they'd hang and burn him in effigy. But in London, when Obama was flown in, they didn't hang him in effigy because they were sensitive enough to know how many black Americans had been lynched throughout history. Now, how is it that foreigners are sensitive to something that whites at home don't appear to be? Here at home, the white supremacy and double standards haven't gone anywhere. We've got one set of rules for black folks, and another set for white folks, and another set for women. You could see it even before Obama got elected, when he was running for president. Remember when he was campaigning and it came out that his pastor, Jeremiah Wright, had made some controversial comments against America? They asked Obama, "Well, how come you didn't leave the church?" Now, Obama's kind and nice, and he responded in a kind and nice way. But if they had asked me that, I'd have said, "Well, I didn't see any Catholic priests and nuns leave the church when the priests got caught abusing those little boys. So why have I got to be different?" Even Hillary Clinton asked why Obama hadn't left Jeremiah Wright's church. I got on the radio and said, "Miss Hillary, whatever Reverend Wright got caught doing, he wasn't breaking the law. But what your husband got caught doing, lying to a grand jury and obstruction of justice, that was a violation of the law. and he insulted and shamed you and your daughter around the world, but you didn't leave him. So the rules change depending on who you are. Even Obama couldn't change that. One thing he did change, though, and it'll stay